You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast brought to you by the barristers of One Crown Office Row, and it covers all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All comments are current at the time of publication, and this episode is presented by me, Jim Duffy. As regular listeners will know, one of the topics we cover quite extensively on this podcast is medical law, which reflects the fact that it's one of the key areas of practice that One Crown Office Row is known for. And in this episode, we bring you our latest clinical negligence update, a canter through some of the more important recent judgments handed down by the courts in this area. And here to discuss them with me are two of my colleagues, Lizanne Gumbel-Casey and Matthew Leach. Lizanne is among the preeminent clinical negligence practitioners in the UK. Called to the bar in 1974, she has been involved in many of the leading medical and personal injury cases in recent and even not so recent memory. She represented more than 700 patients of the jailed breast surgeon Ian Paterson. Aside from her clinical negligence work, she often advises survivors of sexual abuse, recently in cases involving Harvey Weinstein and Jeffrey Epstein. She was awarded the Chambers UK Lifetime Achievement Award. Matthew was called to the bar a mere 50 years after Lizanne, but has already been establishing a practice in clinical negligence, tax and inquests, and has been instructed by the government in immigration and employment cases, and Matthew's academic work has been published widely. Lizanne, Matthew, thank you for joining me. And we're going to limit ourselves to a few cases today, starting off with a major decision on the issue of lost years. Lizanne, as listeners may or may not be aware, in clinical negligence and personal injury claims, more generally, claimants will often have had their life expectancy foreshortened by the alleged negligence and might seek an award of damages for the lost earnings or the lost pension or other income that they would have received had they lived to a normal life expectation. And Lizanne, this was what the Supreme Court in CCC and Sheffield Teaching Hospitals was looking at.
Thank you, Jim. Yes, in CCC was a cerebral palsy case that was heard before Mr. Justice Ritchie, who awarded damages for a child who had very severe disabilities and had a life expectancy only to age 29. There was a claim for loss of earnings, which he was able to assess, but as the child only had a life expectancy to age 29, the claimants wanted to claim for the loss of earnings between age 29 and 68 and then for lost pension. Mr. Justice Ritchie followed the decision of the Court of Appeal in Croke and Wiseman, which was a 1982 decision of the Court of Appeal. It was a decision 2-1 in terms of the judges in that case. And it had long been thought that it was a quite unfair decision that a child could not claim for lost years, whereas an adult could. The justification was often said to be, well, the child will never have dependents to support in the years after they die. But that was not a logical position, because an adult who was injured on a building site and was already earning didn't have to show they had dependents in order to claim in the lost years. What's of interest to me in particular is that Croke and Wiseman just sat as the decision of the Court of Appeal from 1982 until 2025. And yet, when it was argued, and the decision actually took over a year to come out in 2026, and when you read the decision, you wonder how everybody could have followed Croke and Wiseman, because it was found by the Supreme Court to be very illogical that a child couldn't claim for lost years, whereas an adult could. There was no clear line border between when a child was old enough to claim for lost years. They didn't need to have already been earning when they were injured. and it was said to be too speculative to assess lost years claims, but that wasn't a logical argument either, because the child could claim for loss of earnings in the years between 18 or 19 and 29, the life expectancy, having not earned. So what's interesting is that that case was just left there because nobody had a case in which they were prepared to challenge it, because it's only one aspect of a personal injury claim, and to challenge it and lose would potentially eat into the damages claimed by a severely disabled claimant. The interesting thing is that there have been a number of personal injury cases where a decision which is clearly illogical has simply sat there until someone's found the right case to challenge it. Other examples that I've been particularly interested in are A and Hall, which was the limitation issue as to whether the limitation issue for deliberate assault cases was 6 years rather than 3 years with a Section 33 extension. After Stubbings and Webb in 1993, everybody thought that was a very odd decision, that the personal injury claim should have 6 years if it was a deliberate assault. But it wasn't until 2008 in the A and Hall case that the Supreme Court, or then the House of Lords, got to look at it and reverse it.
That was one of your cases, is that right?
It was. A and Hall was the lotto rapist, but there were three local authority cases that I represented the claimants, which were joined up with it, and we all argued it in the House of Lords.
Yeah.
The other one was Lister and Hesley Hall, which reversed the decision in Tea in North Yorkshire, where it had been held by the Court of Appeal in 1998 that a child couldn't sue a local authority for being vicariously liable for a care worker who sexually abused a child, because sexual abuse wasn't within the scope of his employment. Again, it was obviously a wrong decision, because the scope of his duty was to look after the child, not to abuse. And when that was looked at in Lister and Hesley Hall by the House of Lords, they reversed it. And it's another example, and CCC to me is another example of how important it is to try and find cases to challenge what are obviously maverick decisions that simply have to be followed because they are Court of Appeal or House of Lords decisions.
And because of the practical reality that it's going to be very difficult for any individual claimant to take the risk of seeking to overturn it. And I guess it's an aspect ultimately of our common law system that these decisions can be illogical yet remain on the stocks until somebody takes them on.
I think we will have to look out for them and be brave enough to challenge them when there is such a support for it being a maverick decision. And obviously the decision in CCC that there is a lost years claim is an enormous help for accommodation claims, because the younger the child, the longer the lost years claim, and a lost years claim between age 29 and 68 will be hundreds of thousands of pounds in most cases, and will make up a lot of the shortfall from the Swift and Carpenter decision. The other thing that was interesting is that the court confirmed that we all have to speculate in terms of loss of earnings for injured claimants, and that that is in fact the right thing to do, and that the way to do it is to look at the family income and the prospects for that child if they weren't injured. And the Supreme Court endorsed that method of looking at loss of earnings. It's worth looking at that passage from Lord Reed's judgment describing why one has to speculate, but it's not unreasonable to do so. But the sting in the tail, to some extent, is that the Supreme Court did say that whilst it hadn't been argued in this case that nobody should have a lost years claim, that is something that they might need to look at in the future. So it may be a short-lived victory if a case is taken to the Supreme Court to say that nobody should have a lost years claim. And that's something I think we've all got to be looking out for.
Sure. Well, thank you, Lizanne. And staying on the topic of damages, Matthew, you've been looking at Lynch and Princess Alexandra Hospital's NHS Trust. Quite a lengthy judgment, but part of it focused on the issue of provisional damages. Perhaps you could just start by explaining what provisional damages are.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. As you say, Lynch was a decision of the High Court, Mrs. Justice Ellen Bogan, and I'm going to look at the question of provisional damages. And provisional damages allow a claimant in a clinical negligence or a personal injury case to return to the court in the event that something in the future happens. There are tight requirements in order for a claimant to seek provisional damages, and they're set out in statute, section 32A of the Senior Courts Act. And that statute says that the situation needs to be such that there is proved or admitted to be a chance that at some definite or indefinite time in the future, the injured person will, as a result of the act or omission, the negligence which gave rise to the cause of action, develop some serious disease or suffer some serious deterioration in his physical or mental condition. So statutes kind of sets out the requirements for provisional damages. And then the CPR offers the court the power to make such an award so long as a claim for provisional damages has been particularised in the particulars of claim, and the court is happy that the statutory criteria in the SCA are satisfied. The various parts of the statute have been considered and summarised in various recent case law, and in particular, Mrs. Justice Ellen Bogan considers Mrs. Justice Hill's recent judgment in the case of Matthew. And there are three elements, if you like, derived from the statute that a claimant needs to prove in order to seek an award of provisional damages. And they are: one, is there a chance of the claimant developing the disease or deterioration in question? Two, is the disease or deterioration serious? And three, if so, should the court exercise its discretion to make an award of damages? In the case of Lynch, the claimant had suffered from developmental dysplasia of her left hip, and the defendant had admitted negligence. Had they identified the DDH in that case, she would have required early non-invasive treatment and would have had an essentially normal hip. But because of the late diagnosis, her hip and socket had developed abnormally, and so she did not walk normally, and her hip was fixed in dislocation. In Lynch itself, the claimant sought provisional damages in respect of three different risks, the first of which was a complication leading to implant failure before she reaches the age of 47, two, a complication during each revision and prior to the end of its anticipated lifespan, and three, the need for what's called a girdle stone procedure. Mrs. Justice Ellen Bogan was not satisfied that the three statutory criteria were satisfied in respect of the first two risks, but she was satisfied that the criteria were met in respect of the girdle stone procedure. The important takeaway, I think, from this case and in respect of the first two elements is that it's very important to set out precisely what the claimant's case is in respect of each statutory element. Mrs. Justice Ellen Bogan was concerned that the claimant had effectively elided the first two components, that's to say, the chance happening itself and the resultant deterioration. And she said, in respect of the first two, when you acknowledge that the development of a complication would not in and of itself lead to a serious deterioration in the claimant's condition, and indeed the experts agreed that the claimant's function would decline in any event, she was not satisfied that, in fact, the elements of the statutory criteria were satisfied. And therefore, she said that there was no award for provisional damages in respect of those first two risks. However, as I say, in respect of the Girdlestone procedure, she acknowledged that that, in fact, was different. Although there was a limited chance of it happening, less than 1%, the impact of it, she said, would be likely to be profound and severe. And importantly, in respect of the second element of the test, she said its consequences would be readily ascertainable and serious because of their effect on at least the activities and capabilities of the claimant. So in respect of the Girdlestone procedure, the claimant was able to identify that there was a precise serious deterioration arising from the chance of the Girdlestone procedure happening. She said that the relevant risk is clear and severable. It was a clear-cut event, and as a result, there would be consequences arising from it. So considering the differences between the first two risks, I suppose, claimed for by the claimant and the Girdlestone procedure, it's important to be precise in establishing each element of the test and not aligning the risk itself with the generalized deterioration. And my second point in respect of this case would be, even if there is a small chance of a complication developing, a small risk such as 1% or even less is sufficient, provided that a claimant can satisfy the various criteria.
Okay, and I've been looking at a couple of cases that are quite important from a procedural perspective. One about Part 36 offers, which I'll come to, and the case of Ramsdale and Ditta and others, which was about whether a defendant could resil from admissions made on her behalf in pre-action correspondence and in her defence to a claim. The claim of Mr. Ramsdale is in fact still ongoing and due to be tried in June, but this was an application heard at the end of January. In brief summary, and I should say thank you to Richard Smith, our colleague, who's provided a really helpful analysis of the case on our online quarterly medical law review. Claim brought by a man who alleges a negligent delay in diagnosing chronic rhinosinusitis. He eventually collapsed following months of sinus problems and underwent surgery. And unfortunately, by that point, he had a large abscess on his brain and sadly sustained a brain injury that he says would have been avoided with earlier diagnosis and treatment. So one of the defendants is an advanced nurse practitioner, or an ANP, and two admissions were made on the ANP's behalf. One, that she ought to have consulted an earlier clinical record in the claimant's case, and two, that she ought to have referred the claimant's case to one of her GP colleagues for further discussion. So the defence was filed back in August 2023. The admissions that were made were based on expert evidence from a nursing expert. But before the nursing report was ever served, that nurse stopped doing medical legal work. Her solicitors told the other parties about that in May 2024, highlighting the fact that there might be an issue with her continuing in the case. But in this case, there were actually two case management conferences. So the first one took place in July 2024, and nothing more was said, it seems, about this potential problem. By the 24th of July, the ANP solicitors had obtained another liability report from another nursing expert. And after that, the ANP's witness statement was served. And then in December 2024, the new expert provided a further version of his report to the ANP solicitors. So that month, December 2024, there was the second CMC, and again, nothing said about this expert problem. Nothing said about resiling from any earlier admission. And in fact, even when the ANP amended her defence in late February 2025, the admissions were still maintained, so no change. It was only at the point that the new expert's report was exchanged, so May 2025, that the ANP solicitors invited the claimant to consider a draft application to resil from the admissions made. And that application was filed in late May 2025. And for some reason, the hearing of the matter didn't happen until the 28th of January this year. Now, I don't imagine that the ANP solicitors would have relished appearing before the court in those circumstances or being particularly confident about the prospects of their application. But lo and behold, they got the rub of the green, one might think, quite heavily against the odds. And that's because of how the judge approached the exercise of his discretion under the relevant provision of the Civil Procedure Rules, so CPR Rule 14.5. And that's the relevant provision where a party is trying to resile from an admission. It contains a non-exhaustive list of factors for the court to consider. A, the grounds for seeking to withdraw the admission. B, whether there is new evidence that was not available when the admission was made. C, the conduct of the parties. D, any prejudice to any person if the admission is withdrawn, or conversely, if it's not permitted to be withdrawn. E, what stage the proceedings have reached, and in particular, whether a date or period has been fixed for the trial. F, the prospects of success of the claim or the part of the claim to which the admission relates. And G, the interests of the administration of justice. And subparagraph C, the conduct of the parties, well, that was always going to be a tricky one for the applicant in this case, and so it proved. In fact, the judge was scathing of the ANP solicitor's conduct. Their delay in alerting the other parties to the issue, perceived need to resile, was deplorable and inexcusable, according to the judge. But fortunately for them, conduct was just one factor. Another was prejudice, and that was for the judge the key consideration in this particular case. And he went on to essentially carry out a balancing exercise, a balancing of the relative prejudices to the claimant and to the advanced nurse practitioner. The claimant wouldn't, in fact, face any great prejudice in the judge's view. He had the expert evidence addressing the points that the ANP now sought for the first time to put an issue. The trial was still nearly 6 months away, so there was still time in the judge's view to deal with the derailment caused by all of this. And it was clear from what the claimant's leading counsel had said during the application hearing that there were arguments to be made about the change of stance brought about by the new expert evidence. Looking at the prejudice to the defendant, well, the defendant would be denied the opportunity to contest at trial what the judge viewed as a central issue in the case, so quite significant prejudice to the defendant. So the judge allowed the application on the condition that the earlier nursing report be disclosed in addition to the new one. So this is likely to be a case cited where defendants find themselves in a particularly sticky wicket, as this defendant certainly was, and it goes to show the breadth of the discretion available under Rule 14.5 and the possibility, I guess, of a pretty pragmatic approach being taken by the court, even where there's been a long delay for really no apparent good reason. So, Lizanne, that brings us to the next case that we're going to look at, and that's the case of Middleton, which involved a different aspect of procedure that often arises in personal injury cases, and that was an application to rely on surveillance footage.
Yes, thank you. Yes, the Middleton case was actually against Carnival Cruises, and it involved a claimant who was an employee on a cruise liner. She'd fallen over in the lavatories and suffered injury. There was certainly a significant amount of FND, functional neurological disorder, because her injuries were getting worse and worse. So it was not surprising that this was a case in which the defendants produced surveillance evidence. Surveillance evidence has traditionally been much more common in personal injury cases than clinical negligence cases, but I've certainly seen it recently in several clinical negligence cases. And in the case of Cullen, which I'll come to, which was a case against an individual doctor, there was surveillance evidence. The general position is that the court has a very wide discretion as to what evidence will be called at trial. CPR 32.1 provides the court can control the evidence by giving directions as to the issues on which evidence is going to be called, the nature of the evidence which it requires to decide those issues, the way in which the evidence is to be placed before the court, and the court can use its power to exclude evidence that would otherwise be admissible. So it's obviously important to make the application. In the case of Middleton, the application wasn't in fact made until 10 days before the trial was to start, but that didn't mean that the court didn't decide it was relevant to include it, because the defendants had tried to see whether the claimants would agree to it, and it was only very late on that they didn't agree to it. It was obviously going to be very significant because in that case, the claimant said she was catastrophically disabled. Her condition was wholly attributable to the accident, and her schedule was 10.2 million. And the defendant's case was that the claimant's disability that was linked to the accident was very minimal, and they valued the case at 25,000. So there's a massive difference as to what her disabilities were. The surveillance evidence only came to light on the 14th of October 2025, and it related to evidence between March 23 and January 25. And the application wasn't made until January, but that's because the parties agreed that they would meet at a round table in December, and it was only after that round table was unsuccessful that the defendants made the application to admit the evidence. And the judge found that it would be so unfair if the defendant couldn't rely on it that even though the trial date would be lost, it was admitted and the trial date had to be moved, and relied to some extent on the claimant not grappling with it when it first came to light in the October. So in terms of surveillance evidence, that case and another case called Perrin and Walsh that was decided only a week or two before the Middleton case set out the steps that need to be taken. And I would summarise them in the way that the first issue should be the integrity of the surveillance evidence and whether it's fit for purpose, and that was the reason in Perrin and Walsh why the judge wouldn't, certainly on the first application, admit it, because it was not in a form that was reasonable for the claimant to deal with. It wasn't complete and it wasn't presented in a way that described as having integrity. And until it's provided in a comprehensible and complete form, there should be no question of admitting the evidence. So that's the first point a claimant might take, is that the evidence isn't in a suitable form to be admitted, even if it is appropriate to admit it. The second issue is whether the evidence goes to showing something that the claimant is able to do that the claimant claims they're unable to do. And it's important that surveillance evidence doesn't just show the absence of something. And this was an issue that arose in the case of Cullen and Dr. Ruth Henniker-Major, where the defendant, which was a clinical negligence case, the defendant sought to rely on surveillance evidence to show that the claimant wasn't using carers. And as the judge said, if you random hours of standing outside the claimant's house, taking pictures of nobody arriving, didn't prove that the claimant never used any carers at all. So the second point is the evidence has got to positively show something that's at odds with what the claimant claims to be able to do. The third issue, which is important, is that the claimant has an opportunity to respond to the surveillance evidence, because otherwise it may be seen as an ambush. And the main point that claimants take in trying to keep out surveillance evidence is usually ambush. What happened in Middleton and why the application eventually was made so late was that defendants did give the claimant the opportunity to respond to it, and the claimant put in a number of witness statements seeking to respond to it. So it's important that even if it's supplied late, there is time for the claimant to put in evidence responding to it. And then the fourth issue is whether the reason for the surveillance evidence being disclosed, what appears to be quite late or quite close to trial, is that they've been waiting for the claimant to confirm that they still have the disability they're claiming for, and that the most recent medical evidence still supports it. And you can see why defendants want the claimant to pin their colours to masters, to, for example, not being able to walk and only being able to go out in a wheelchair before they disclose the evidence showing the claimant walking around, because otherwise the claimant may say, well, that was the case, but I've got better. So they can legitimately wait for the claimant to confirm the level of disability, and that comes from the case of Douglas and O'Neill. Then the last point is, if there isn't an ambush, the surveillance evidence is in a proper form and positively shows the claimant achieving something the claimant claims not to be able to do, then it will almost certainly be admitted. And that goes right back to a case called Morrell and Hume in 2001, which was a Court of Appeal case, and Lord Justice Potter said, in principle, it seems to me the starting point on any application for this kind must be that where video evidence is available, which according to the defendant undermines the case of the claimant to an extent that would substantially reduce the award of damages to which he's entitled, it will usually be in the overall interest of justice to require that the defendant should be permitted to cross-examine the plaintiff and her medical advisers upon it, so long as this does not amount to trial by ambush. And the only real reason it will be an ambush is if the claimant doesn't have an opportunity to deal with it. So I would say that a claimant with a genuine case for damages for personal injury is in a much stronger position if they agree to the surveillance evidence and if they try and keep it out, and that they should, as soon as they get the surveillance evidence, take witness statements or any other evidence showing why the surveillance evidence is not undermining their case. And to try and exclude it would normally, to me, be seen as a sign of weakness. And certainly whenever I've been served with surveillance evidence, I've said we've got to deal with this and agree to it rather than try and have a contested application to exclude it. Because if it's harmful, it's going to be admitted. If it's not harmful, you don't mind if it's admitted anyway. And often it puts the claimant in the quite strong position for saying the defendants are being unfair. I mean, I've had surveillance evidence where one of the issues was whether the claimant could manage her financial affairs, and the defendant served evidence of the claimant going to a cash machine, and she stood there, looked at it, looked in her handbag, pulled out a comb, pulled out various other things, couldn't work out how to put a card in the cash machine, then looked again at the cash machine and walked away.
So incredibly helpful.
And if anything proved that she didn't understand how to take cash out, the video evidence did.
Yeah.
And they were trying to say, well, just because she can approach a cash machine, she can obviously manage her money. So claimants can be helped by it, and I think claimants are often very keen to exclude it when that's not usually the best approach.
Yeah.
But you do have to go through those tests to make sure that it's been properly provided.
So quite a lot of detailed guidance then on surveillance footage. And Lizanne, you took us through the last year's case of CCC, but Matthew, there's another area of the law that has fairly recently made its way up to Supreme Court level, and that's secondary victimhood, the circumstances in which someone who was not the primary victim of a tort can nonetheless recover damages through having witnessed it in some way, sometimes referred to as nervous shock. And those Supreme Court cases have now been the subject for a while of interpretation in some first instance cases, haven't they?
Yes, Jim. The case of MIM recently was considered by the High Court. In that case, MIM had attended hospital with his wife, and she was induced for labour on the evening of the 30th of May 2020. The trust in MIM admitted that there had been negligent mismanagement of that labour, and sadly, as a result, the baby suffered a brain injury, and had, in fact, the baby been born 3 minutes earlier, the baby would have avoided that brain injury. MIM witnessed this series of events, and in particular, he identified several components as giving rise to the psychiatric illness which resulted from witnessing them. He said the bleeping of the alarm during the course of events and the trust's reassurance that the baby was fine, the consultant telling him that an extra 15 minutes would be allowed for things to progress, being told that the baby's heart rate was low. He also relied on his extreme worry about what was going on and confusion as to who was doing what. And this elapsed over a period of time, several hours. The claimant described what happened as a continuum, witnessing this horrific series of events. But the High Court struck out the claim under CPR 3.4a as a result of the Supreme Court's fairly recent decision in the case of Paul and Wolverhampton. In Paul, a majority of the Supreme Court held that a secondary victim needs to witness an accident or the immediate aftermath of an accident in order to bring themselves within the requirements to claim as a secondary victim. Instead, a medical crisis which is witnessed by a secondary victim is insufficient. So in the Paul case, for example, there had been alleged mismanagement or misdiagnosis in respect of the primary victim's heart condition. And several months later, over a year later, he collapsed whilst out shopping with his daughters. And the Supreme Court had said, well, you didn't witness an accident. Instead, what you witnessed was a medical crisis as a result of the previous negligence. And so no claim was allowed. This first instance case shows Paul being interpreted in a way which most practitioners, I think, would have expected, in that whilst secondary victim claims for clinical negligence are available, the result of Paul is to significantly restrict their recovery. And so whilst there may be situations such as where a primary victim is injected with the wrong drug, that was a scenario which Lord Burroughs, he dissented in the Supreme Court, picked up on, is witnessed by the secondary victim, that might be said to constitute an accident. But these broader, prolonged periods of time, perhaps described as a continuum, are insufficient. I think the difficulty in respect of MIM is if we look at the facts, they're not too dissimilar from previous cases of Walters or Renane. And the Supreme Court had overturned Walters and had said that Renane should have been decided in the way it was on the basis that there was no accident. I think the further point that's interesting from MIM is the definition of an accident. The judge in MIM picked out paragraph 24 of Paul and identified an accident as something which is an unexpected and unintended event which causes injury or a risk of injury to a victim by violent external means. I think we're still not clear on what unexpected and unintended perhaps means. In MIM itself, the court said that what MIM witnessed could not amount to an unexpected and unintended event because, for example, the sounding of an alarm on a monitor during the course of labour is not unexpected or unintended. It's what would happen. But the question of unexpected and what needs to be unexpected and by who, I think, still need to be answered. And similarly, unintended and by who still needs to be answered. And I don't think MIM takes us any further in respect of clarifying those two questions, if that is the definition of an accident that the court is going to rely on. Finally, I would say in respect of MIM, the period of time I think was fatal. If it was to be refined and a precise moment was identified during labour where, for example, there was a negligent incision, thinking about the external element, that may be the type of case where secondary victim could be recoverable in clinical negligence. But I think simply a delayed labour case where there's a prolonged period of time is unlikely to fall within the accident definition as provided by the Supreme Court and is much more likely to fall on the medical crisis side of the line, unfortunately.
Can I just add to the secondary victims in clinic cases, because I'm obviously interested in birth damage cases and where there might be a secondary victim, and the sort of starkest example I can think of, which would be a better case to test it on, is a forceps delivery where the baby is pulled out with a crushed skull, or where there is a maternal death through excessive bleeding. So I don't think we're at the end of the line in secondary victims in birth damage cases, let alone other clinical negligence cases. And I think the better case to test it on would be a baby being, because it would be an accident if the baby came out with a crushed skull because the forceps had been put on the wrong place.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the best example I can think of.
Yeah, it's less decision-making and more a real visual moment, I guess. I'm conscious that I said earlier that I would look at Part 36. And for listeners who are not lawyers, well, Part 36 of the Civil Procedure Rules in England contains a regime designed to encourage and facilitate the settlement of claims. So if a party makes a Part 36 offer and it's not accepted, then the party who made the offer goes on to do better at trial, then there are usually additional costs and damages consequences. So say a claimant makes a £500 offer, it's not accepted, and then they win at trial and are awarded £600, then there are Part 36 consequences to that. So our colleague Josephine Lunnan has written about a recent Court of Appeal case in our Quarterly Law Medical Review, and it's called Smithstone and Tranmere Primary School. And the Court of Appeal in Smithstone looked at whether Part 36 only applied to monetary offers, so the type that I've described, or whether it could also apply to percentage offers. So in Smithstone, for example, the claimant had made an offer to compromise a case on a 90-10 basis. So in other words, we'll take 90% of the damages if you settle now, and then we don't have to contest the issue of liability. We don't have to establish negligence. And ultimately, the answer of the Court of Appeal was yes, Part 36 can apply to those types of offers too. And that was the unanimous judgment of the court delivered by Lord Justice Bean. So the 90-10 offer in this case was made in December 2028. It was rejected by the defendant. The case had been entered into the low value fixed cost regime because of its low monetary value. And in March 2020, the claimant made another offer, this time a monetary offer of £3,500, which again was never accepted. So the claim went to trial. The defence witness, as sometimes happens in low-value fixed-cost cases, didn't turn up, causing them to seek to try to settle the case at court. And they did so for £2,650, so less than the claimant's previous monetary order. But the claimant nonetheless argued that they'd obtained a result at least as advantageous as the 90-10 offer. And the trial judge said, no, this was a fixed cost regime case. The claimant's offers did not bite for the purposes of the relevant provision of the CPR, which is CPR Rule 36.17. But the case then goes to the Court of Appeal, and the Court of Appeal considered the wording of 36.17, and it asked itself several questions. So first, was there a judgment? Well, yes, there was a judgment in this case. There was an order and judgment. And then the next important question for present purposes was whether a percentage offer could engage CPR 36.17. And here the Court of Appeal has been seen as having overturned the approach that had been taken in an earlier case, the case of Monday and Tui UK Limited in 2023, where Mrs. Justice Collins Rice had, on an appeal heard in the High Court, been concerned that a 90-10 liability offer could be used as what she described as a unilaterally imposed insurance policy to reverse the losses otherwise provided for by CPR 36.17. So in other words, the claimant could fail to beat a defendant's financial offer, but because of their percentage offer, could still benefit ultimately from Part 36. And that, for Mrs. Justice Collins Rice, ran counter to the clarity, simplicity and predictability, as she described it, essential to the incentivizing effects of CPR 36.17. The Court of Appeal disagreed and in fact viewed what Mrs. Justice Collins Rice had said in Monday as having been obiter, so a part of the judgment that was not essential to the decision made. There'd been two previous cases, Huck and Robinson from 2002 and Broadhurst and Tan in 2016, which the Court of Appeal lamented had not been cited. In the Monday case, Huck was a 95-5 split on liability, and the Court of Appeal had found in that case that part of 36 consequences could flow from such an offer. So there's no bar at all to a percentage offer, say a 90-10 offer, being effective for the purposes of part 36. But to use your phrase you used earlier, Lizanne, there was a sting in the tail, because in this case, there was never any determination of liability or even a 91% liability result. There'd been no admission of liability, no findings of liability. So that comparison between what the claimant had ultimately achieved and what had been offered at an earlier juncture just couldn't be made. So a Pyrrhic victory, one might say, for the young claimant in Smithston. And that brings us to our second last case, Lizanne, and you have been looking at the case of LXLP and St George's University Hospitals.
Yes, thank you, Jim. Yes, so this was a case where breach of duty had been admitted, but the claimant failed on causation. And I always think that causation is the first thing that we need to look at in clinical negligence cases, and often start conferences by looking at the causation issues, because unless the claimant can prove causation, however stark the breaches of duty are, the claimant is not going to succeed. And looking at the cause of damage to a brain damaged baby is usually the most important aspect of it. It was damage to a premature baby, which are always quite difficult cases because of the issues as to why the baby is born prematurely and what the cause of it is. The claimant was born on the 10th of May 2016, and the mother's pregnancy had been uneventful until the 25th of April. So the relevant period of treatment was between the 25th of April and the 10th of May. And she was 27 weeks and 5 days gestation on the 25th of April when she reported leaking fluid, which was preterm, pre-labour rupture of membranes. And from that, there is a risk of infection. And the defendants accepted that there were opportunities to administer antibiotics, which were missed between the 26th of April and the 10th of May. What happened was that there was infection, there was chorioamnionitis, and an ascending maternal amniotic infection, which triggered preterm labour. So the reason for the preterm labour was the infection, and the MRI scan showed periventricular leukomalacia, PVL, as the damage to the baby. Now, the only argument that the claimant had was that antibiotics should have been given earlier or different antibiotics given, and that would have prolonged the labour to some extent. But on the facts, the claimant was not able to demonstrate that different antibiotics would have prevented the claimant's injury. There are numerous potential and credible causes of chorioamnionitis. And by the end of the microbiologist's evidence, it was clear they were unable to say that erythromycin would have been likely to eliminate the potential and credible causes in the claimant's particular case. So it's a very fact-sensitive case, and one where the microbiology evidence was very crucial to what the difference in outcome would have been. But what's quite interesting and is often the case is the judge did comment at the end of the case that this case is about medical treatment of two patients, the claimant and her mother. It's also about the way in which they were treated as people at a very significant time in their lives. Mother felt she was not being listened to by the consultant who was in charge of her care, as the serious incident report records. I trust it remains a lesson learnt at the hospital. The factual context of the hospital not listening to mother, having departed from its own guideline, and given the very serious condition which the claimant and her parents now live with, parents wished to bring the claim is not surprising. Mother formed the understandable impression that medication was omitted, which would have changed the outcome. And I think that's so often the case, that the way that the patient is treated, and parents often know best whether their child is at risk or their fetus is at risk. And there's an admission that she wasn't given antibiotics at the right time. It's not surprising that the claimant would want to bring a claim and the mother to say, I should have been given the antibiotics. But the fact is, unless you've got supporting expert evidence to show it would have made a difference in your particular case, you're not going to be able to bring the case. And you know, the judge can be sympathetic to the fact that mother wasn't well treated, but can't find for the claimant unless you've got the right supporting clinical evidence. And what really made this case fail was the agreement of the microbiologists as to the fact that you couldn't show it would have made a difference. And if you've got that position, you can't really fight these kind of cases, however poor the treatment appears to have been. So it's quite a lesson on really looking carefully at causation before you run clinical negligence cases.
Thank you, Lizanne. And that brings us to our next Supreme Court case, Matthew, Lewis Ranwell and G4S Health Services and others.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. In Lewis Ranwell and G4S Health Services and others, the Supreme Court considered whether a defendant could rely on the illegality defence where a claimant had been found not guilty by reason of insanity. The facts of Lewis Ranwell were that the claimant had been diagnosed with schizophrenia, and in the days leading up to the events in question, he had been arrested and detained twice. Now, during these arrests, he had behaved in a violent and erratic way and had appeared mentally very unwell, said the Court of Appeal. Although a Mental Health Act assessment was discussed, no assessment was arranged and the claimant was released. He then killed three elderly men under the delusional belief that they were paedophiles. As I say, at his criminal trial for murder, he was found not guilty by reason of insanity, and he was ordered under the provisions of the Mental Health Act 1983 to be detained in a secure facility. And the claimant subsequently sought damages from the defendants, and his case was that he should have been kept in detention during the arrest until it was safe to release him. The defendant sought to strike out the claim and submitted that because the claimant had committed an unlawful act, the illegality defence applied. At first instance, Mr. Justice Garnham held that the illegality defence was not applicable and allowed the claim to proceed. And similarly, in the Court of Appeal, Lord Justice Underhill and the President of the King's Bench Division agreed, but Lady Justice Andrews dissented. The Supreme Court considered this case and overturned the decision of the first instance judge and the Court of Appeal and said that the illegality defence did apply. Interestingly, there is no prior English authority on the question of illegality in circumstances where a claimant has been found to be insane by a jury and therefore acquitted. But the Supreme Court said that in any event, illegality did apply here. Important in the court below and at first instance was the distinction the criminal law draws between the partial defence of diminished responsibility and the full defence, if you like, of insanity. Previous English case law had considered that the partial defence of diminished responsibility, which reduces or substitutes the offence of murder to one of manslaughter, did engage the illegality defence. But they had found that the difference with insanity was that the turpitude or the mental element of the murder was not there because the claimant was found to have been insane. But the Supreme Court said that, in fact, the threshold for illegality was met where a claimant was found to be insane in a criminal trial. They said that the distinction drawn between diminished responsibility and insanity in the criminal law did not determine tort liability and that civil law was different. And in particular, they considered the general principle, the moral principle, that thou shalt not kill was fundamental in English law. And instead, the distinction drawn by the Court of Appeal was not determinative in the way that they had suggested. The Supreme Court said that it was a factor which was relevant, but it was not a determinant in the previous case law in Gray and Thames Trains and Henderson and Dorset. And they said it fails to recognise that in a novel circumstance such as this, the court should primarily address the question of coherence of the law. And as a result, they said that the threshold for the defence of illegality being engaged was satisfied on the facts of this case. And so having established that the threshold was met, they turned to the second question, which was the Patel and Mirza assessment. They considered the three questions: the purpose of prohibition, other relevant public policies, and the proportionality of denying a civil claim. And they said, considering those factors outlined in Patel, it was appropriate for the illegality defence to be engaged here. The other interesting point that arises from Lewis Ramwell is that whilst it restricts claims in tort by claimants, the human rights avenue is still available because of the Court of Appeal decision in Al-Hassan Daniel and HMRC from 2010. So whilst Mr. Lewis Ramwell can no longer pursue his claim in tort because of the illegality defence, he can still pursue his claim under the Human Rights Act.
There was one thing I was going to add is that the claimant didn't have a litigation friend, so they were able to manage their own litigation, and yet the argument was that they didn't have the capacity to know what they were doing, and that did seem completely at odds with not needing a litigation friend in the civil claim. And I think that's something that maybe the claimants hadn't considered the significance of that sufficiently.
Yeah, I think the Supreme Court did highlight it sort of in passing, and I think at the beginning of their judgment mentioned this. I think, of course, we have to think about the condition that the claimant suffers from and schizophrenia, and whether or not there could be variations in respect of his mental condition and variations in capacity, which is, of course, time specific. So I wonder if that's the response to any concerns in relation to litigation friend. But it's very interesting that an individual could be acquitted by reason of insanity in a criminal trial and be detained in a secure institution by statute, yet appear to have the capacity to litigate a civil claim. As Lizanne says, it seems difficult.
Well, thank you, Matthew. And we've only really scratched the surface in terms of the slew of important clinical negligence decisions since our last update when I spoke to Ben Seifert back in May 2025. But luckily there is, as I keep plugging, the Quarterly Medical Law Review, which listeners can find at 1COR, that's number 1COR, QMLR.com. It's a free service. It's full of articles written by barristers who do clinical negligence work day in, day out, and it's regularly updated. Lizanne, Matthew, thank you so much for sharing your expertise, and I hope we can tempt you back onto the podcast very soon. If you have any feedback on this episode, then please email us at lawpoduk@onecore.com. In the meantime, from me, Jim Duffy, and from Lizanne Gumbel KC and Matthew Leach, thank you for listening.